Screen Time with John Fardy.
Thanks to Airtainment, a new era in Irish streaming begins. Discover more at airtainment.com.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, Phil Rosenthal, the creator of Everybody Loves Raymond and star of Somebody Feed Phil on Netflix, chats to me about his long career and coming to the Three Olympia in Dublin for a live show where he's going to eat a sandwich on stage. The runners and riders and possible winners are assessed in this Sunday night's Oscars. And of course, we will pay tribute to the great and now sadly late Gene Hackman. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com, the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all, and I hope you're doing well as the sun returned to Irish skies occasionally this week, which was nice to see. It felt like a long winter. There's a lot on the show this week and a lot happening in the world, and we're going to get to Gene Hackman very shortly. We're also going to get to the Oscars very, well, not that shortly, but we have to talk about the Oscars. But I saw a brilliant movie this week that I want to talk to you about.
It's going to be a no for today.
I mean, you can just write somebody off like that? This is how it works?
This is how auditioning works. Thank you. Bye, Sherry. Next.
I worked really hard. Please. Please, I worked really, really hard.
You know what? I can tell you worked really hard, and I'm sorry. It's just, if you were a really good dancer, it would be different. But your technique isn't great. Okay, you were obviously hired at the Razzle Dazzle because you were beautiful and young a long time ago.
Now, that was Pamela Anderson in a horrible moment in an audition in the new movie The Last Showgirl, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 28th of February. You may have heard about this. Gia Copeland directs this, and it's Pamela Anderson in Las Vegas. And she's been in a show called Razzle Dazzle, which is kind of, it's at the end of the Las Vegas Strip in a kind of old world casino. It was big in the 80s. It's kind of can-can dancing of sorts. She's semi-nude, but her, for want of a better phrase, the flower is fading, or that's the way the world is seeing her. They're going to get rid of this show, and the glory days of her career in this kind of can-can show are coming to an end, and she's thinking about what she's going to do, and she feels like she's given her life to this, and it's all going to come to an end. She has other things going on in her life with family members and stuff that I won't get into. But this is shocking to me, having seen it, that she wasn't nominated for an Oscar for Best Actress, because Pamela Anderson is wonderful in this. She is playing all sorts of things. She's seemingly naive at times about it, but also incredibly heartfelt. You know, she's long been compared over the years to her Marilyn Monroe. And at times in this, she purposely almost sounds like her. She does some brilliant things with glances and expressions in this movie. And when she's hearing news she doesn't want to, she just handles it brilliantly. She gives a brilliant performance in this, a career-defining performance. And the movie around it is great as well. It's probably not a huge movie. It's a quiet kind of movie. Dave Bautista is in it as well, who plays kind of the guy managing this show that she's in. Jamie Lee Curtis is a friend of hers who's working in Vegas as well, is brilliant in it. And the way this is shot, it's kind of indie cinema making of sorts. This kind of beautiful off blue skies in it as well. But Pamela Anderson is, I don't want to say a revelation, but she is brilliant in this. And I suppose the fact that there is some element of art imitating life, possibly, or, you know, being in this business that might eat you up and chew you and then not care about you, you can't help but think about all that. This is a brilliant performance, and I think it's a crying shame she wasn't nominated for Best Actress. So do yourself a favour and go and see The Last Showgirl, because it is a great watch and I enjoyed it immensely this week. Do get in touch with me to let me know what you might have been watching. John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. En route to Gene Hackman, I just want to quickly tell you I've also started the new season of The White Lotus. It's very good so far. The only feeling I'm having is this is exactly like season one and two, in that all these people go to a luxury resort. This time it's in Thailand, and weird stuff happens. The weird stuff that's happening is very good, but they're just, to me, so far, a few episodes in, beating a very familiar path. but let's see what happens. Now, there was huge, you know, adulation and sadness about the passing of Gene Hackman. And we'll park the circumstances of his death, because this is a movie show and I just want to talk to you about his career. But there was such an outpouring for him that I was delighted to see. It kind of reminded me this week slightly of when David Bowie died, when people seemed genuinely upset at his passing and just remarking on his long, long career. So I think he was, now sadly not is, but was quite simply one of the greatest actors of all time. And I want to bring you a montage, a piece I did a few years ago about him when he was still very much alive, although he hasn't acted or hadn't acted in a long time. And at the time of talking to you, it's been 20 years. So this was a walk of fame we did all about Gene Hackman. And in case you're wondering why people are so sad and so, you know, waxing lyrical about his performances, well, hopefully this will give you a flavour of it.
Are you listening to me?
Yes, I am! I think you're having a nervous breakdown.
An article a few years ago described Gene Hackman as America's greatest living actor. And another summed it up by saying, 79 films, 2 Oscars, and no bad performances. Those performances have such range and versatility that Gene Hackman is simply always great.
Give me the gun.
This is the hardest thing I've ever had to do in my life. But I swear, I'll do everything I can to help you out. Everything. I'll get you the best lawyers.
Lex Luthor, the greatest criminal mind of our time.
Of our time?
I hereby serve notice.
He's serving notice to you.
That these walls.
That these walls here.
Will you shut up, please?
You got a stupid smile, you know that, pal? Can you see it? Did you smile when the bodies were covered over?
Hackman is an unusual actor. He's played tough cops and sinister politicians, sheriffs, fathers, the whole gambit of characters. Yet he looks like the quintessential everyman, like he should be driving a bus or something. But you can't take your eyes off him on the screen.
Well, I find that hard to believe, that you'd go away completely alone.
I didn't say I was completely alone.
I think you said that you weren't with anybody.
I mean nobody you know.
I know a great many people. How can you be certain it's somebody I don't know?
Hackman was born in 1930 in California, but his father moved the family around a lot, and they finally settled in Gainesville, Illinois, where his father worked as a newspaper printer. Like just about every actor and actress, there was an early wound in Hackman's life when his father left him, quite literally with a wave of his hand. Here's Hackman giving a rare interview on Inside the Actor's Studio.
Well, my dad left us when I was about 13, I guess.
Was it easy, hard?
No, it was tough. Yeah.
Tough. Mm. I've read that there was a sort of casual wave goodbye.
Yeah, I was down the street playing with some guys, and he drove by and kind of waved, and
that was it. Were you close to your mother?
Yeah. Excuse me.
Did life change radically?
It's only been 65 years or so, you know.
Hackman dropped out of school at 16 and joined the Marines. But the teen hadn't signed up due to any overwhelming sense of national pride, as he told David Letterman.
What were the circumstances leading up to the decision a 16-year-old kid makes about going into the Marine Corps for you?
I couldn't get laid, you know, and
Hackman worked as a radio operator and was stationed in China during his time. Upon leaving the Marines, he took several odd jobs as well as studying journalism and TV production. He resolved to give in to his desire to become an actor, and he studied at the famous Pasadena Playhouse Theatre in the 50s. Dustin Hoffman was one of his fellow students, and they became fast and lifelong friends. They also shared the dubious distinction of being voted the least likely to succeed by their peers in the playhouse.
He was kicked out after 3 months. They said he had no talent whatsoever. And the serious part of this is that he was so natural as an actor, because I did scenes with him, and he was so natural that they didn't think it was acting. So they didn't know what he was about. He was that good.
Hackman next moved back to New York, where he worked in summer stock and off-Broadway, and eventually made small film roles. But it was a long struggle, and he was 37 when he finally got his big break. Hackman was cast alongside Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway in the era-defining Bonnie and Clyde. He plays Clyde's older brother, Buck, who tells bad jokes and loves being part of the bank-robbing gang.
Ma's a teetotaler, he says, that she wouldn't touch a drop. Well, I'll tell you what you do, that's the doc. I'll tell you what you do. you bring in a fresh quart of milk every day and you put some brandy in it, see? And do you try that? So he did, and he doctored it all up with the brandy, the fresh milk, and he gave it to his mama. And she drank a little bit of it, she didn't, you know. And she called him over and she said, son, whatever you do, don't sell that cow.
After the success of Bonnie and Clyde, Hackman tread water for a little while, doing good work but not getting the leads he deserved. But that all changed in 1971 with a gritty cop thriller. In The French Connection, Hackman played Popeye Doyle. Based on a real-life cop, Hackman made his detective a real anti-hero like we hadn't seen before. An unpleasant man who got the job done.
I've got a man in Poughkeepsie who wants to talk to you. You ever been to Poughkeepsie? Huh? Have you ever been to Poughkeepsie?
Hey, man, come on, give me a break. Hey, what you talking about?
Let me hear you say it. Come on. Have you ever been to Poughkeepsie? You've been to Poughkeepsie, haven't you? I want to hear it! Come on!
Yes, I've
you've been there, right?
Yeah.
You sat on the edge of the bed, didn't you? You took off your shoes, put your finger between your toes and picked your feet, didn't you? Now say it!
Yes! All right. Now I'm going to bust your ass for those three bags and I'm going to nail you for picking your feet in Poughkeepsie.
The French Connection ushered in an era of gritty 70s movies. And it was actually the first R-rated movie to win the Oscar for Best Film. Incidentally, Hackman also won the Best Actor's Award. Hackman's next movie was one that really spoke to mid-70s America, and the Watergate scandal in particular. In The Conversation, he plays Harry Call, an anally retentive, painfully shy surveillance expert, whose only outlet is playing a saxophone. He becomes obsessed with one particular bugged conversation, and his obsession ultimately leads to tragedy. It's a masterclass in acting.
What the hell are they talking about, for Christ's sake?
Stanley, please, I'm trying to get this done.
All right, don't get excited, man.
Well, I'm getting fed up.
About what?
About your asking me questions all day long.
Jesus.
Don't say that.
Well, for Christ's sake,
Stan, don't say that again, please. Don't use that word in vain. It bothers me.
It's curiosity. Did you ever hear of that? It's just goddamn human nature.
Listen, if there's one surefire rule that I have learned in this business is that I don't know anything about human nature. I don't know anything about curiosity. That's not part of what I do. This is my business.
En route to his continuing era-defining movies, Hackman made a small cameo in Mel Brooks' horror spoof Young Frankenstein, where he plays the blind man who encounters Frankenstein's monster. Maybe he was trying to send a sign that he didn't just do dark and gritty.
My name is Harold. And I live here all alone. What is your name? I didn't get that. Nope. Oh, forgive me. I didn't realize you were mute. You see how heaven plans. Me, a poor blind man, and you, a mute. An incredibly big mute.
After Frankenstein, Hackman was back to, well, dark and gritty again, when he reprised the role of Popeye Doyle in The French Connection 2. This time Doyle goes to Marseille in France to try and bust the French drug kingpin, who he's been pursuing in New York.
Popeye, Mr. Doyle, I was requested to help you. I didn't request that you come here.
I've been a New York cop for 14 years. I know that the dope that comes out of this city has killed a lot more than I have. Look, I'd rather be a lamppost in New York than the president of France, but I came over here one thing and one thing only, that's to get Chaunier, and that's what I'm going to do.
In 1978, Hackman joined a pretty super franchise. In Superman, Hackman showed once again that there was just about nothing he couldn't play. his comic portrayal of supposed criminal mastermind and Superman's nemesis Lex Luthor was right on key, and he would play that role in two more sequels.
You diseased maniac.
I told you. It's kryptonite, Superman. Little souvenir from the old hometown. I've spared no expense to make you feel right at home.
You were great in your day, Superman. But it just stands to reason. When it came time to cash in your chips, this old dude, diseased maniac, would be your banker.
Into the 80s, Hackman continued to explore different genres and types of characters. Not all the movies were great, but you couldn't fault any of his performances. With Hosiers in 1986, he tackled the role of a new coach who leads a small-town basketball team to victory. His locker room speech has entered the annals of the great halftime locker room speeches.
There's a tradition in tournament play. Not talk about the next step until you've climbed the one in front of you. I'm sure going to the state finals is beyond your wildest dreams, so let's just keep it right there. Forget about the crowds, the size of the school, their fancy uniforms, and remember what got you here. And most important, don't get caught up thinking about winning or losing this game. If you put your effort and concentration into playing to your potential, to be the best that you can be, I don't care what the scoreboard says at the end of the game, in my book, we're going to be winners.
In 1988, he starred in the tense drama Mississippi Burning, about two FBI agents investigating the death of three civil rights workers in a racist South. He showed that well into his 50s, he could still be a badass.
You get this straight, shit kicker. Don't you go mistaking me for some whole other body. You got your brains in your dick if you think we're just gonna fade away. We're gonna be here till this thing's finished. How about you, Deputy? Is that gun just for show? Or do you get to shoot people once in a while?
He got an Oscar nomination for that performance, and he won an Oscar in 1992 for Best Supporting Role opposite Clint Eastwood in the marvelous revisionist western Unforgiven. He plays the sheriff opposite Eastwood's former gunfighter. It's one of the greatest westerns ever, and Hackman's final scene is brilliantly fraught.
You'd be William Money out of Missouri. Kill women and children.
That's right. And I'm here to kill you, Little Bill. I don't deserve this. To die like this. I was building a house. Deserves got nothing to do with it. I'll see you in hell, William Money.
Into the noughties, Hackman gave a magic turn in Wes Anderson's quirky Royal Tenenbaums, where he plays the wayward father of a family of tortured geniuses, who pretends he's dying so he can get back into the house.
Baby, I'm dying. Yeah, I'm sick as a dog. I'll be dead in 6 weeks.
What'd they say? What's the prognosis?
Take it easy, Ethel. Hold on, baby. Hold on. Hold on.
Where is the doctor?
No, just wait a second now. Wait a second. Okay, listen. I'm not dying. But I need some time. A month or so, okay? I want us to...
What's wrong with you?
Damn. Ethel!
Are you crazy?
Ethel, baby, I am dying.
Gene Hackman made three more movies after that, and he hasn't been in a movie since. We should have gotten worried in 2004 when in a rare interview with Larry King Live, he had this to say.
I don't have a project, Larry. If you have a script, I'll read it.
Nothing's on. There's no script in front of you. There's one's calling Gene Hackman.
No, it's probably all over. So this is like
this is
career ended on Larry King Live.
Right.
It was no joke, though. And despite many offers, he hasn't been in front of a camera since. He's had a second career as a novelist, where with his writing partner Daniel Lenihan, he's written 4 historical novels, as well as 2 novels by himself. When asked during a GQ interview in 2011 if he'd come out of retirement, he said, "I might consider it if I could do it in my own house, maybe without them disturbing anything and just 1 or 2 people. But I hope I've reminded you that he deserves his place among Pacino, De Niro, Nicholson and Hoffman. In fact, he may even have it by a nose."
I'll tell you one thing, though. You got more grit, fire and guts than any woman I've ever met. What? What are you smiling about?
Nothing.
No, no, what's so funny?
Nothing. Just these little expressions of yours.
I don't know what you're talking about, but I'll take it as a compliment. You're true blue, Ethel. You really are.
That is the life and times of the now sadly passed Gene Hackman. Hopefully that gave you a flavour of why he's such an important actor. That was from a few years ago. That is the legend that is Gene Hackman. Up next, Phil Rosenthal, star of Somebody Feed Phil and the creator of Everybody Loves Raymond. Now, you're welcome back to News Talk's TV and movie show, This Is Screen Time. Phil Rosenthal is the award-winning creator and executive producer of Somebody Feed Phil, not to mention the beloved sitcom Everybody Loves Raymond. He's coming to the 3 Olympia Theatre on Saturday, the 19th of April, for a moderated conversation. It's part of a European tour he's doing. Phil will be telling funny stories, true stories about his life, his television career, food, travel, friends, and family, and whatever you're having yourself. Somebody Feed Phil is kind of a cult classic on Netflix at this stage and has been renewed for a staggering 8th season. And I'm delighted to say, by the powers of something, we go live to the west coast of America. And hopefully, Phil joins me now. Hello, Phil.
Hello, here we are.
It's wonderful. You are on the west coast of America, aren't you?
I am in Los Angeles, where it's sunny and beautiful.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. So listen, my long intro there, we'll get to your thing in the Olympia, but I suppose a big, wide question for you. You know, in terms of people I talk to directors or producers or writers, or I talk to people in front of the camera, actors, comedians, TV stars. And traditionally in Hollywood, and even still today, it tends to be you're either in one lane or the other, and that's where people like you. You've very successfully transitioned to doing both, and having been the creator and producer on Everyone Loves Raymond to now be fronting your own series for this length of time. Was that hard to do? Was it a hard nut to crack?
Absolutely, yes. It took a very long time because you hit it on the head. It's really hard to switch lanes like that. And my own agents, even at the time, thought I was crazy. And it took 10 years to get the show. Between Everybody Loves Raymond and the initial show, I'll Have What Phil's Having, which was on the our national public television service. That's where we started. That took 10 years. And then it was, and then we didn't continue on PBS, I think for financial reasons. And then thankfully Netflix came and picked it up. And like you said, we've been running 8 seasons. We're one of their longest running, if not the longest running original series in their history.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty incredible. And, you know, forgive me if you've been asked this a lot, but I'm wondering, when you conceived of the idea, did you look around and see other travel/food shows and go, man, I could do this a lot better?
No, I never said I could do it better, but I thought that I could do it a little different. In fact, here's how I sold the show. You ready? This is the one line that I said that actually sold the show. I said, I'm exactly like Anthony Bourdain if he was afraid of everything.
And it only took 10 years. I like that. Let's get to the TV show. I was rewatching some of it last night because I've seen it many times. Like, I know that, you know, people do these things and it's it seems like, God, he's the best job in the world. But I get there is a huge amount of work. I know a bit about TV. But at the same time, you do seem to be having a great time. Like, I know there's a lot of work involved, but it must be a terrific gig.
I have to be completely honest with you, John. It is a lot of work, but not for me.
Right.
It is a lot of work for my brother, and who's the executive producer of the show, mm-hmm. and John Podolos, who's our director, and everyone on our crew, and all the fixers, and all the people who really work. What you see me doing, and the reason I look so happy on the show, is because I'm having the time of my life. It is the most fun. It is everything you could imagine it to be, and then some.
Yeah.
So if I look joyful in the show, it's because I truly am. I'm living the dream.
Yeah. I'm sure you're asked a lot, oh, tell me your favorite meal, but I won't do that. But I'm wondering, was there a food intake, let's call it, whether it's a meal or not, or on the side of the road, that really surprised you, that you thought either this is going to be horrible or this is going to be delicious, and it wasn't either of those?
That always happens. You know, I'm flashing back to Japan where they served me a salad with ants on it. And I don't know about you, but I don't eat that regularly. And I thought maybe the restaurant has a problem, you know, that they should call an exterminator. But I was told that these ants taste like lemon. And I said, really? Well, if it's lemon flavor we're going after, could I have some lemon? And they said, you got to try it. And so I figured, listen, you have this show. You wanted a food show. Here you go. You got to do it. And the cameras are rolling. And I took all the courage I could muster to put this one big black ant in my mouth and crunch down on it. And I swear to you, it was as if someone put a lemon drop on my tongue. I couldn't believe it. So, of course, now I'm asking the chef, do you baste these in lemon? Is that why they taste it? No. These particular ants from this part of the forest and this part of Japan, they taste like lemon, which brings up the question, who found this out? How many ants did some poor guy have to try before he found the lemon ant?
Good question.
So it's things like that where I'm not seeking this stuff out, but if it's offered to me, I think I have to at least be polite. Because it may be strange to me, but it's not strange to them. And I'm in their world. I'm a guest. And so do I have limits? Yes. There was a scene in Oaxaca, Mexico, and they were feeding me all this delicious food. I loved it. And then they asked me if I would like iguana. I said, excuse me? They said, it's right over there. And they pointed to a half-cooked, full iguana. And I said, I'm not proud of this, but I said, oh, look at the time. We have to run. You know, the crew can't stay late. And so they offered me a bowl of moving, living beetles instead. Wow. And I said, oh, God, no, thank you. I really have to go.
I'd do anything for TV, but not iguana as meatloaf, might have sang or something like that.
I mean, at least the ant was not moving. This was moving. All the bugs. I'm really, like I said, not that brave. But I have to tell you, I am getting braver the more we do the show, and you would get braver too the more you travel. That's the whole point, is to leave your comfort zone a little bit. Listen, for most people, just getting off the couch is going out of their comfort zone. Yeah. This show is for them because I was like that. I was truly afraid to try new things. But now, you know, our biggest fear is the unknown, right? But how do you cure that? Well, you make things known. You experience them. And most of the time, they're never as bad as you think. Even jumping in the water off the coast of Greystones.
Well, I was going to get, because I rewatched the Dublin episode last night and I really enjoyed it. And I really liked the fact that you were basically saying, you know, we haven't been known for our food, but we need to look again, because that's actually true. And we've had a food revolution. But I say this with love and respect. I'm going to give you one piece of advice. It could be construed as a criticism, but it's not. But going forward, never again say top of the morning to any Irish person, because the only people who actually say top of the morning are Americans to Irish people. The only time I've actually ever heard it in Ireland was at a Billy Joel concert. And as much as I like Billy Joel, I thought he was going to be booed off the stage for saying it. So just a little nugget for you going forward in your future endeavors.
Thank you so much. Because what do I know? I'm just an American who gets the culture off the TV and movies. So if I saw it in a movie or a TV show, now it's stuck in my head. I guess that's what people say.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you look, I've corrected.
How that started and why we think that that's a nice thing to say in Ireland?
I've heard differing reports about it. It might have been some movie that was shown on BPS or PBS or something like that.
Yes, yes.
I think, but I'm not entirely sure. Maybe you can tell me.
I have no idea where I heard it. It just like if you asked an American, what do they say in Ireland to say good morning? They say top of the morning to you. So I'm thrilled to learn. I don't need to say it. I could say good morning like a person.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for taking it on the chin. Listen, I want to ask you about the live show that you're doing. But before that, I just want to quickly ask you about Everybody Loves Raymond.
Sure.
I'm wondering at this stage now, when you look back on it, what do you think you landed on that made it so successful? Because it's hard to overestimate the success of it. Like I read this thing earlier about how it reinvigorated the channel it was on, and just it was the sweet spot of kind of a sitcom. Like is there you know, you're good at one line pitches. Was there something looking back you think you had that hadn't been before or since?
Well, it's easy to look back now and tell you what I think it was. I had no idea if it would work then. I had worked on other sitcoms, though. And
sure.
I liked them or didn't like them to a certain degree. But this one, I thought I found in Ray Romano a vehicle to write about my own family. And that turns out to be the secret. The more specific you get in your writing, the more universal it becomes. Because we all relate to each other's specifics, even if they aren't theirs. For example, if I saw you obsessively concerned about something, even though that wasn't my obsession, I would relate to your obsession because I'm obsessed about something else, right?
Mm.
So the relatability factor is, I think, what we had. We would, if you worked for me, your job was to go home, get in a fight with your wife, and come back in and tell me about it. And the whole show, 90% of the stories were things that either happened to me or to Ray or to one of the other writers. And we made each other laugh in the writer's room. That's the first sign that you might be onto something.
Hmm.
Because if you can't make yourselves laugh, what chance do you have making other people laugh?
Yeah.
And so the biggest compliment we ever got was, you were listening outside my house last night.
Okay.
And we got letters from people all over the world once it started going around the world. We got letters from Sri Lanka saying, that's my mother.
Yeah.
I don't know this person's mother. I was writing my mother.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that's it. The guest was stellar. They were wonderful, that you could tell what they were thinking just by the look on their face. And that's always, I think, the key to a great sitcom is you know what the characters are thinking. You know them so well that they do seem like your family.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That's a very good way of putting it. And listen, I'm not going to be crude and ask you how much money you made, right? Because I don't actually want to know. But I'm wondering, did the success of it give you a tremendous amount of freedom? Because that's what I hear a lot from people who strike it big with a TV show or a movie, that, you know what, I didn't have to worry for a while and I could figure out what I wanted to do next. But that may not have been your experience.
It was absolutely true. Could I have waited 10 years and pursued this love? So people think because I had success on Raymond, they just gave me Somebody Feed Phil because I had success on that other show. No. Like you astutely pointed out, they don't like you switching lanes.
Mm.
So even though I had that success, I had to struggle, really struggle, and work very hard to get the show. 10 years. But I could only do it because I had a little cushion of money to so that I wouldn't starve while I was doing it.
Tell me this then. We get to the Olympia, the Three Olympia next month, Saturday. Nice night to have a gig, the 19th of April. So, like, people might be wondering, oh, that's the guy off the Netflix show. What's he going to do on a stage?
Yes. My joke is that I'm going to come on stage and I'm going to eat a sandwich and then I'm going to leave.
Stadium-filling material.
I guess we got what we paid for. No, I come out, we show a little highlight reel of the show, and then I come out with a moderator, and I tell funny stories of my life and Raymond and this time trying to sell the show, and there are some very funny stories about that, and sure. Then all the behind-the-scenes stuff of Somebody Feed Phil and anything else you want to know. You know, I've been doing this for now 30, 35 years, so mm-hmm. I've amassed a trunk load of stories about, well, a lot of famous people in Hollywood and the world. And that's the first half of the show. And the second half of the show is Q&A with the audience, which is my favorite part. So if you're mm-hmm. listening, I want you to come. I want you to think of anything you want to ask me. I'm very good at relationships and marital problems and problems with your parents or your kids. You know, I had a lot of experience. Like I said, we drew from real life to write these mm-hmm. shows. And I'm still an expert in these things. And so it's the most fun for me is getting to meet all of you wherever I go. That's really fun. I hope you'll be there, John, so I can
absolutely.
Say
absolutely. Well, listen, he has lived a life most extraordinary. You can see him in the Three Olympia Theater on Saturday, the 19th of April, for I guess we're calling it a Phil Rosenthal live show. So, Phil, we look forward to seeing you there, and thanks a lot for talking to me.
Thank you so much, John.
Phil Rosenthal there talking to me about his fascinating career, fascinating guy. And as you heard there, he'll be in the Three Olympia on the 19th of April. Up next, who's going to win at the Oscars? Now you're welcome back to the last part of Screen Time. Well, it's the biggest night of the year for movie nerds like me, the Oscars. Who's going to win? Who's going to be disappointed? You think I'm a movie nerd? You ain't seen nothing yet. Chris Wasser, how are you?
John, I'm well. I'm happy to be described as a movie nerd with you.
Yeah, excellent. I thought you might be. So yeah. Listen, let's get down to it. I think it's fair to say at the outset, it's hard to call this year. Last year, Oppenheimer was leading the way. Let's start with Best Actor. Where do you think that's going to land?
Yeah, you're right. It's so strange because in terms of Oscar predictions this year, it's been so wide open. Golden Globes, BAFTAs, the Screen Actors Guild Awards, they've thrown up surprises in some categories. I mean, some actors have been, you know, dead cert since the beginning. But 2024 was much easier to call. I mean, last year, we would have been shocked if Oppenheimer wasn't taking, you know, the top male acting prizes. We would have been shocked if Emma Stone hadn't won Best Actress. Best Actor this year, it's, I mean, for me, so my heart says Adrian Brody, because Adrian Brody's performance in The Brutalist is probably the best lead actor performance I've seen over the past 12 months. I thought it was sensational. I hadn't seen him that good in such a long time. Delighted that he had that role because, I mean, well, but Adrian Brody's always been good, but hasn't always had the chance to kind of show us how brilliant he is. Like going back as far as like The Pianist was nearly 20, was it 20 years ago?
A long time ago.
Yeah. So he hasn't had a role this good in such a long time. But Timothée Chalamet winning the Best Actor trophy, or the Best Actor, as they call it, at the Screen Actors Guild Awards. That's completely thrown me, because what you have there is those awards are voted for by the performers themselves. And when it comes to the Best Act, when it comes to the categories at the Oscars, you have the directors voting for the director prize, the actors voting for the actors. You're talking about the same members there, John. So mm-hmm. I'm thinking, is Timothée Chalamet going to sneak past it? Because I thought Adrian Brody's biggest competition was Ralph Fiennes for Conclave. So the short answer is, I don't know. And the long answer is, it's between Brody, Chalamet, and Fiennes. I hope it goes to Brody.
But you think at this stage it could go either of three ways, basically?
It could, yeah. I would not be surprised. But any one of those guys is they're definitely going home with it.
Yeah, okay. Best Actress then.
Yeah, again, wide open. Now, if you'd asked me at the beginning of award season, I probably would have said that, you know, the Carla Sofia Gascon for Emilia Perez was definitely going to take this. This film has had an awful lot of buzz behind it ever since Cannes. Have you seen it yourself, John?
I have, and I interviewed Zoe Saldana and Selena Gomez. Yeah,
and so it's just, look, Yeah, and it's a good show. Everyone's very good in this. Carla Sofia Gascon is terrific in it. Great stuff out of Selena Gomez, who I actually thought would be nominated for an Oscar. I think it was a little bit overrated. I think it's quite untidy, you know, that sort of blend between melodrama and musical. And
it's certainly dividing people. Lots of people I know have watched it and went, what the hell is this? A bit like, you know, Everything Everywhere All at Once, The Shape of Water. It's kind of in that category. But why do you think she's no longer a frontrunner? There's been a bit of controversy about it.
There has been a bit of controversy because being nominated for an Oscar is worse than being, you know, running for US president because you know that people will be scouring your entire background and all of your social media accounts. But in terms of Carla Sofia Gascon, let's call it as it is, there were racist tweets a few years ago that she had posted between 2019 and 2021. And those tweets were unearthed by a Canadian journalist who put them online and said, I can't believe that this, you know, X account is still active and that the tweets haven't been deleted. Carla Sofia Gascon subsequently deleted the tweets, deleted her X account, issued an apology, but then probably made things worse by going on television and sort of maybe defending herself a bit too much.
Yeah.
Anyway, look, we could talk about it all day. The short story is that Netflix severed all ties with Carla Sofia Gascon. They have pushed Emilia Perez. They've changed sort of the campaign to focus on Zoe Saldana for supporting actress, Jacques Audiard for, you know, the fact that he made the film. And so she's gone from favorite to definitely not winning. She will attend the Oscars, apparently, but I don't think she'll be winning. She's
dead in the water now.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
So that leaves it to who then?
That leaves it to Demi Moore or Mikey Madison for Anora. Yeah. So Demi Moore for The Substance. Yeah.
Yeah. This is the one that really not confuses me, but you have two things here, but you tell me what you think. Like Demi Moore, she gave a gorgeous Golden Globe speech. And I've said this a few times where she talked about, you know, this was a full circle moment because she was told she was just a popcorn actress and she needed to accept it. And it was lovely. And I just thought, by God, that's a Hollywood story. You know what I mean? She's going to win the Oscar. But then I saw Anora. I thought Mary Madison is brilliant in it. And it's wide open, I would say. But you tell me what you think.
Yeah, I think Mikey Madison is a tremendous performer. And I've always been a fan of Sean Baker's films. And it is quite nice that Sean Baker's films, you know, are getting the awards attention that they've always deserved. Anora is a terrific film. But I think this might go Demi Moore's way. Because like every now and then, the Academy does like to kind of reward, you know, the veteran with the comeback story. You know, we saw it with two very different stories, but we saw it with Brendan Fraser for The Whale, where it's just like, you know what, this is an actor who hasn't always been treated well in our industry, who's given this sensational performance in this film that everyone's talking about, and there's an awful lot of goodwill towards. I mean, there's an awful lot of goodwill towards this strange and queasy body horror that some people actually walked out of the cinema from. Look, I do think it's a great performance. I had problems with The Substance, but I won't have a bad word said about Moore in that film. She's terrific. Yeah. It's almost a case of, you know, art imitating life. The story about an actress who's constantly told that she doesn't have it anymore because of her age. And it's just, it's been brilliant to watch.
So
her
is she going to win?
Comeback. I think so, yeah. I think it's between her and Madison, but I think more of my Pipper to the poster. Yeah.
Is Best Supporting Actor a slam dunk for Kieran Culkin?
I reckon so. We said that a couple of months ago when we were talking about A Real Pain. There's not it's Kieran Culkin's to lose. A very close second, maybe Guy Pearce, but Guy Pearce hasn't really been collecting the awards for The Brutalist, and he is very good in that film. But I would love to see it go to Kieran Culkin, and I don't think anybody would be complaining if it goes to Kieran Culkin.
And we'll be guaranteed a good speech should he win. It'll be quite un-Oscary, whatever he says.
You know? That's true.
Yeah, so we'll be looking forward to that. And then I'm wondering, because of all the controversy around Sofia and Emilia Perez, do you think Zoe Saldana will get it just by virtue of they want to, and I'm not saying she's not very good in it, I thought she was great in it, but they do want to recognize this movie for all sorts of reasons, that they're going to give supporting actress to Zoe Saldana? Or what do you
Absolutely.
Think?
Absolutely. Yeah, I did think a few weeks ago that the Academy would maybe steer clear of Emilia Perez altogether, because 13 nominations, John, that puts it in line with All About Eve, Titanic, La La Land, you know, it puts it one behind the Academy record shared by those three films. And I'm not quite sure it deserved the 13, but I think we do need to maybe separate put Carla Sofia Gascon in one corner and put the other performers in. Don't basically tarnish them all with the same brush. Mm-hmm. It's because Zoe Saldana is very good in that. It is well made by Jacques Odiard. I think Saldana will probably win it because she has taken the BAFTA. She took the Golden Globe. She took the Screen Actors Guild Award. She hasn't lost in any of the categories, basically. So I think it's hers to lose.
Yeah, I spoke to Jesse Eisenberg a couple of weeks ago and I thought he was delightful, really good company. I'd love to see him win for best screenplay. Do you think he might?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
A real pain, I should say.
Yeah, because no, it is. I was thinking about this category and it's between Eisenberg and Coralie Fargia for The Substance, which is truly an original piece of work. But Eisenberg's film, it is lovely. It's been so strange that Culkin is getting an awful lot of recognition for A Real Pain when you have Eisenberg in the form of his life, you know, a brilliant multitasker, writing, directing, producing, and starring in it. He is the lead actor in it, and he hasn't picked up any nominations for his performance. But for his writing, I think he performed so well on that film because we were talking about it on the show before, where he has this lovely thing where he knows when to laugh at himself, and he knows when the story should try and make you laugh, but he also knows when to take it seriously because it is such a delicate subject matter. Two Jewish Americans visiting their families, you know, horrifying past, and going to Poland to visit their grandmother's birthplace. It's a lovely piece of work, and I'd love to see him be awarded for it.
Yeah. Okay. So en route to telling me your prediction for Best Picture, tell me in one sentence each, who's going to win for Best Director and who's going to win for Best International Feature?
I think it's between... Oh, you can actually answer this question for me. Is it Brady Corbet or Grady Corbet? I've been talking about this with colleagues all week.
That's hard to know, actually. I'm going to plead the fifth on that one.
Right, we're just going to have to ask him because I do think it is between Brady Corbet or Brady Corbet and Sean Baker. Brady Corbet, obviously, for The Brutalist, Sean Baker for Nora. I think it is between those two guys for Best Director. Before we get to Best Picture, for International Feature, probably Emilia Perez because it's never going to win the main prize. I think it will take the international feature though.
Yeah. And I should remind people that is now on Netflix. If you want to watch it this Saturday night, have a look and see what all the fuss is about. Okay. So I was going around through the list of the top 10 pictures or the 10 nominees in Best Picture. I think you and I have practically reviewed all of these together.
Probably.
We've certainly discussed most of them. So I'm going to ask you two questions on it. What do you want to win? What do you think will win?
I'd love to see The Brutalist win. I thought it's not a perfect film. I mean, at nearly 4 hours with a built-in interval, it was never going to be. But I think it's so beautifully performed. It's so ambitious. It's original. It gets the best out of Brody and Guy Pearce, two performers that I love. Sensational. I'd love to see it win. I do think, however, maybe Nora might just squeeze past it for Sean Baker. But again, been a fan of Baker's work for years. That would be fantastic for him. And then also the other competitor there is Conclave. And in other years, John, you know, going back years, like Conclave is the big Oscar winner film, isn't it? You know, it's this, it is very much an Oscar bait type film. I think it's maybe between the three of those. Wicked is never going to get it.
No.
I don't think James Mangold's Bob Dylan film, A Complete Unknown, is going to get it. There are some fine films in there, but I think it's between those top three that I mentioned.
And if you had to, gun to the head,
right?
Who's actually going to get it on the night? Do you think most likely?
Nora.
Really? I would say The Brutalist.
I think so.
Because I think it's good for cinema making that a 3.5 hour movie or 3:35 could get Best Picture. And I think that's the way they're going to go, if I had to call it. But I agree. I think Nora's the second and then Conclave. But look, we will know and we will text each other immediately once we find out. So Chris Wasser is saying most likely by a nose is Nora. I'm saying The Brutalist. We will find out. From one movie nerd to another, Chris, thanks a million.
Thanks, John.
Chris Wasser there giving me his thoughts on the Oscars. I'm very excited about it this year. Movie nerds, I say to you all the time, it gets people watching movies, so I'm fine. I don't care who wins in a way. I just want the Oscars to keep going. And I'm particularly excited about Conan O'Brien because I think he's one of the funniest men alive. And I do like him very much. So I'm looking forward to seeing what he does with it. That is it for this week. Next week on the show, at the time of talking to you, next week I'm going to be talking to Danny Dyer about his new movie, Marching Powder. In the meantime, I'll just remind you this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. If you want to get in touch with me at any stage, John_Friday is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Leave you with a little music from the movies. A couple of weeks ago, there was a brilliant Luther Vandross documentary aired called Luther, Never Too Much, all about Luther Vandross. I made this bold statement on the hard shoulder that having watched this documentary, I think he might have had the greatest soul and R&B voice of all time, possibly even better than Michael Jackson and Prince. There, I said it again. But this was a great documentary called Never Too Much Luther, all about his fascinating life and times and how he was such a big star and how he struggled with so many different things in his life, like his weight, his sexuality, and how the perception of those was made and seen in the 80s. It was a brilliant, brilliant watch. It's still up on Sky. Do check it out. And of course, it featured some great music. So I'll leave you with the titular track of that documentary, Never Too Much. So I'll leave you with that and wish you a happy remainder to your weekend.
Screen Time with John Fardy.
Thanks to Airtainment.
Saturdays at 6 p.m. on News Talk.